This lecture has been given, it was given at the International Conference of the Society in Adyar at the end of last year, in December of last year. And it was published in the International Theosophist, the magazine, April, May of this year. And if you're interested, you could find it. It mightn't be exactly the same as I give it to you today, but the basis of this lecture was published in that magazine. In world history, there have always been periods of peak achievement. And these periods have always been energized by a sense of wonder. It is this sense of wonder which provides the stimulus in the lives of the men of those times, which carries them into a realm of creative activity which is far beyond that which they would normally achieve in life. Now, possibly the best known are the Greek periods, of course, were of this within this category, but probably the best known to you is the Elizabethan period, because there, with Shakespeare and the other poets, the foundation of the translation of the Bible, the foundation of English literature was laid. But as well as that, the explorers, and they were toughies, like Raleigh and Drake, and the soldiers of that time who fought the Spaniards, they were not only adventurers and first class in their military work or their naval work, but they were poets, and their poetry is still existent today. So at these periods, men approach life fearlessly, and they seem to get beyond the usual restrictions of human nature, so that they feel themselves one with the energies of nature. And they seem to be aware that they are one with the energies of life and are part of a transcendent whole. And so because of that, they become more than life-size figures. They stand out in world history just as the period in which they live also stands out. Now, there's a very interesting book published by the Quest of the Theosophical Society and written by a man called Ken Wilber called The Atman Project. I should have asked beforehand whether you have it in your library, but it's a very good book. In that book, the author indicates his personal belief that every man, even those like us, who are probably less than life size, every man is unconsciously aware that he is one with all life. Every man is unconsciously aware that he is one with all life, that each soul or each subject knows or intuits that he is Atman, that he is God, that he is the divine energy in his innermost nature. We don't realize this, perhaps. It's not easy for us to fear to recognize this fact. But there is something inside us which makes us go on living. There's something which gives us that urge to live. And it's the same in all nature. And that springs from the one energy which has been called Atma. And so, in his true nature, man is part of an infinite and eternal wholeness. But Wilber points out that at the same time, the subject is terrified of real transcendence, of becoming one with the whole. Because to become one with the whole, he has to go through the rather frightening experience of losing his separate and isolated self. And man is afraid of that because he's got this build-up of self-identity about which I'll talk later, and he doesn't want to lose it. So by holding on to his sense of selfhood, the personality ego which he identifies in normal life, by identifying with that personality ego, he shuts out the Atman, the whole. And although subconsciously he intuits that he is part with it, he tends to shut it out because he is more aware of that ego, which is his personality. But in these periods of peak achievement about which I've spoken, man succeeds in doing just this. He lets go his separate self in the excitement of discovery or of serving his beloved Queen Elizabeth, in the case of the Elizabethans. Now, when we come to the question of treading the spiritual path, we have exactly the same thing. To reach a spiritual a knowledge of the spiritual realities, an understanding of the spiritual nature and how it can be developed, we must let go of our sense of separate selfhood while trying to understand the nature of wholeness. Now, one of the founders, the principal founder of this society, was Madame H.P. Blavatsky. And she said, I don't know what it is here, it isn't, it's probably outside. She said that this wholeness was to her the one absolute reality, which is beyond the reach of the human mind. And that's important, beyond the reach of the human mind. We can only understand it in a very limited way. And from what I've already said, it will be obvious that I am convinced that the understanding of wholeness cannot be expressed through that the understanding of wholeness can be experienced best through the emotional or feeling aspect of our being. It arises from that sense of wonder, which I've spoken about, and which we feel in our hearts when we identify, even for a moment, with the wholeness of life. And again, there is a book written, and you may have this in your library, by, it's on Jung and transpersonal psychology. I think it's written by Stephen Holler, who spoke to us at the convention in Perth in Australia about 18 months ago. And he had this to say, which is exactly the same as what I've been saying, but expressed in slightly different words. No matter how open our minds may fancy themselves to be, to the mysteries of life they may fancy themselves to be, these mysteries can never be contained by the confines of the conscious mind. The gnosis, which is the esoteric knowledge, the gnosis of old was always a knowledge of the heart rather than the ego knowledge of the head. The mysteries can never be made to fit into a limited scope, the limited scope of the personal mind. And many students of life, following the traditional Western method of analytical thought, because we tend to pigeonhole and we have a very strong duality in our thought, we say, this is that is that, and that is that. And there is a difference between them, black and white. So we pigeonhole, we compare, we use the analytical method in our normal thought. And today, in this new age, where the method of thinking, the method of experiencing life is changing, many of these people who have used the Western approach, the analytical mind approach, find them stranded on a road which is purely mental in its nature. Now, theosophists, and some of you will be students, I expect, we should have known better. Because in that wonderful little book of ethical teaching, Light on the Path, we are told, study the hearts of men that you may know what is that world in which you live and of which you will be a part. And the same thing is said, if you want to understand the world in which you live, you can understand it best through understanding the hearts of other people and ultimately your own nature. And H.P. Blavatsky, in The Voice of the Silence, which is another wonderful little book, put it this way. Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the I from the heart doctrine. And the difficulty we face today, and you'll all know this, is that man has placed his trust almost completely in his mind, which over the last few centuries has developed to a peak of perfection at the expense of heart and spiritual qualities. The amazing scientific and technological developments of recent years appear to vindicate the belief that his mind alone can lead man to an understanding of life and the universe in which he lives. This is the premise on which the whole of Western society has been built, that mind alone can lead us to understanding. But in fact, that mind of which he is so proud is basically only analytical and comparative. It is rooted in duality, and it breeds separativeness, competition, and uniformity, whereas that which is required for understanding wholeness is a recollection of interconnectedness, the interconnectedness of all things. And this comes from synthesis, from a building up, and from coordination. And these are the faculties of mind when that mind is balanced with the heart. In fact, it's gone so far, many scientists today who have split the atom, handled nuclear powers, and genetic, or dabbled in genetic engineering and so on, they are now considering themselves masters of nature. But this is very dangerous, because nature, which is the energy field of that whole, about which I earlier spoke, will hit back and will force us to recognize that nature is that all-powerful, transcendental whole of which we are a part. And because we are a part of it, we are governed by the laws of the whole. You will all recognize that changes today in the world are taking place so rapidly that it's very difficult for us to understand. You know in a car how the speedometer moves over, and perhaps you get 99 changing to the 100. But today the position is quite different. We've got 99,999 changing to 100,000. The whole speedometer is, as it were, turning over, moving forward in a very, very short time. Sometimes I think, years ago I used to call this in a lecture, the birth pangs of brotherhood, because we're being forced into brotherhood. We're being forced to take a quantum leap, a leap as it were all together in consciousness, from intelligence to intuition. And already we see a swing from the yang to the yin, to use the Chinese symbol, the S curve. Perhaps sometime we should cover this in more depth. But we see a movement from the dominance of the masculine attitude in life towards the feminine, or from the gods to the goddesses. And the keen focus of mind is giving way to the universality of feeling and emotion. When feeling links us with a consciousness which lies beyond mind, the Christ consciousness, or in theosophical terminology, the Buddhic light, then starts the process of coming together which leads to brotherhood or oneness. You think about your lives, and you will realize that emotion provides the drive in life. The mind may guide, but it does not generate power. It uses knowledge, and knowledge is always limited to that which we know. It cannot take you past that which you know into new creative fields. But the feeling aspect of human nature is unlimited, and that can open for us the gates of the wondrous world in which we can consciously experience oneness. This is a religious experience, the basic religious experience. And religion is usually defined as a belief in an invisible, superhuman power on which man regards himself as dependent, dependent on God, if you will, and to which he thinks himself in some degree responsible. Now that's the first part of the definition, together with the feelings and practice which flow from such a belief. In other words, if you believe that there is a power, one energy power in the universe, then you react to it emotionally and then you use that which is the power of religious emotion. So the belief is secondary to the feelings, because religious emotion is among the most intense and profound experiences that can be known to man. And all such experiences come from a sense of awe and wonder in the presence of the mysterious and transcendent, which carries man beyond himself and engages him in deepest commitments, loyalties, and creative activity. So, you know, one of the best ways of understanding life is to look upon nature as this general and all-pervading power and recognize the great precision which characterizes the structure and the function of matter and forces us to recognize that behind all nature there is intelligence and purpose. We can then recognize that the whole universe and even space is alive because it's part of that one energy field. And the mere thought of this immense universal being is awesome and fascinating. But actually, the true sense of wonder only comes when we realize that we ourselves are part of this wholeness. And because our activity has normally, our mental activity has for centuries been rooted in duality, man has considered himself separate and different from God. I don't know what background you've all been brought up with. But you know, this is an amazing thought. We have considered ourselves separate and different from God. Even today, few of us realize that devotion to a God who is outside ourselves is perpetuating this duality and obscuring the essential nature of oneness, because we are part of that oneness. H.P. Blavatsky was well aware of the need for a concept based on oneness and interconnectedness when she postulated this one absolute reality, an infinite and eternal cause, which is all that was, is, or ever shall be. And she said it was devoid of all attributes. It is beingness rather than being. She further affirmed that the soul of every man is fundamentally identical with this absolute reality. Each of us is an undetached spark of the one fire. And this is the basis of the whole theosophical teaching. And let me try, seeing this has been a bit difficult, to put this in simpler words. God, to use the commonplace word, is the one reality and is all that exists, visible and invisible. The life which is in everything and the forms through which that life expresses itself. Therefore, you could say that God is nature, the one great energy, all-inclusive, all-embracing energy field. Or you could say that God is life, and all things are God. It's wrong to say that God is in us. We should really say God is us, because you remember what I said right in the first, that we are, even if unconsciously, aware in our deepest inner aspect of our consciousness, that we are one with that wholeness. We are him, or we are it. It's interesting to use that word it instead of the capital H-E that we normally use, because one of the best concepts seems to me that of a tremendous field of force, beneficent. Its foundation is love. And it's in that field of force that we live and move and have our being. And everything there is emanates from that one source, which the Chinese call the Tao, usually spelt with a T, but evidently pronounced as Tao. The center where all things are one. The center where all things are one. And I have already said that the mental approach cannot lead us to a full appreciation of oneness. Now I'm going to contradict myself and use a few concepts which may lead us to an understanding of that, to an understanding of that oneness. I don't know if you can see that. I haven't got a slide. I have a slide of this, but I haven't brought it with me tonight. Now, if you take white light, ordinary white light, and pass it through a prism, a glass prism up here, then that white light in passing through the prism is split up into the colors of the rainbow. And each of those colors is not a sharp definition between orange and yellow, but a gradual movement from red through orange to yellow. In other words, there are an infinite number of variations of vibration or wavelength in that spectrum, in that rainbow. Are you with me? It goes from red to indigo or purple, and at each stage there's a slight difference of vibration. So we can actually get an infinite number of different vibrations in the colored area of the spectrum. But if you bring up another reversed prism close to the first prism, that colored rainbow, which represents the diversity, can be brought back to the one white light. So all those colors are still, in their essential nature, the white light. So we, as the individual variations or unique variations of that energy field in the rainbow, we, as each of those variations, are still the white light. And that is what I'm trying to say. We are that oneness. So I'm going to suggest that the life process is the splitting of the white light of oneness into color units, which by their self-conscious effort will return to their essential true nature, the white light of oneness. And there is in that actually the whole of the explanation of what is called the evolutionary process, which is not my subject tonight, but which is an interesting one. You could have a look at that later if you wanted to. It'd be up there. Now the second example is an intriguing one. Have you played with those maze puzzles where you have a little bit of mercury and you have to get it to go round and round and up to the top or through a lot of little mazes into the center? You know the one I mean? Well, now, quite often you don't do it quite right, and that blob of mercury is split up into little droplets. You know how that can happen? Now, the mercury droplets, if you adjust the game properly, can be brought back into the one blob, the one large drop. But if you had those mercury droplets on a separate sheet, as it were, or a dish, and you threw dust or sand upon them, they would become contaminated and they would not join together. They would stay as little drops side by side, but because their surface was covered with impurity, they would not join together. So this means, in this analogy, that oneness cannot be produced until each unit of the whole loses the impurities of its separate existence. When the little globs of mercury are the same, all the same and all pure, they will come together. When they're contaminated with dust or dirt, they will not come together. So there is the question of impurity hindering the understanding of oneness. Now the next point I want to make is that the oneness is there all the time. If you have a light in a fog, you know that it's difficult to see the light. You're aware of a glimmer in the distance, as it were. But as the fog is dispersed, you can see and become aware of the brilliance of that light. Another way of looking at it, if you had a light bulb and you had seven, if you're talking about the, as you have been in some other lectures about the vehicles of man's constitution, the bodies as they're sometimes called, if you had that light there and you had seven concentric circles of opaque glass around it, then you would find that if you looked through all seven of those, you would have a very hazy view of the light, the source of the light, the bulb. But every time you took away one of those circles, you would get nearer to the real understanding of the light, and when you removed the last circle, there you would have the true light. So the oneness is always there. It's our consciousness, our conscious understanding of it, that makes it difficult for us to realize that it is there. The last illustration is the pebble in the pond. If you drop a pebble into a tumbler of water, then you displace every portion of water in that tumbler. If you drop a pebble into a pond, you do actually displace every particle of water in that pond. This seems to indicate the interconnectedness of everything. Every particle of water was displaced. So the great force field of nature is one, and every action, every thought, every feeling emanating from us as individuals or from others or from everybody is actually having an effect upon the whole. The world in which we live is interconnected. Everything is interconnected, and everything has an effect on everything else. This was put by the poet Francis Thompson in The Mistress of Heaven, I think. All things by immortal power, near and far, hiddenly to each other linked are. Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star. The poet's way of putting it. And John Donne said, no man is an island. We are all part of the one continent. To me, the best illustration of oneness is that of a great energy field which constantly exerts a pressure on all life to express the perfection which is latent within it, its unique quality in the wholeness, its unique color in the rainbow of life. And this all-inclusive energy field is us and is all around us, but we create cages that separate ourselves from its formidable power. Another way of putting what I've said earlier. And as I said at the beginning of my talk, at times in the world's history, and today is such a time, we become aware of the pressure of the life energies as they bubble up to the surface and force change upon us, both in the wider sphere of our social institutions and in the more intimate sphere of our personal lives. And I recently read a description of the mighty Niagara River, where it emerges from the rapids and provides a vivid analogy of what I'm trying to express because of the tremendous power of the flow of life energies, because it expresses an analogy for the tremendous power of the flow of life energies about which I'm talking. And I'll quote from this extract. The immense torrent, after being pent up between two steep banks of the rapid, pours itself as a mass of rushing water into a large open space. Its oily, smooth surface, filled with whirlpools, shows but little of the tremendous power and the undercurrent that are there. Yet watch it as it swirls against the, or eddies against the banks, and the viciousness as it goes into the backwaters, or again from the middle of its surface, a huge tree trunk lying horizontal and quite placid, or seemingly placid on the surface, is suddenly uprooted, tossed up, and sucked down into the huge turmoil of the current at that place, and it is kept down until it reappears hundreds of yards further down the river. And this is like the force of life, and we are all too often just puppets in this mighty stream which is life. We may be vaguely aware of its forces, its tremendous, its tendencies, its direction, and we may even be warned of its dangers, but our real aim should always be to cooperate with the prevailing current and with full self-control, utilize the power of that current, utilize life for the more perfect expression of our little unit within the great flow. And that's why there's a book written some years ago called In Tune with the Infinite, and that is the concept of being in harmony, living in harmony with the song of life. And we will be buffeted by the great river of life until we lose all sense of self-separativeness. I remember that one of the presidents of the society illustrated the idea of the law of cause and effect by saying that every action of ours was like throwing a ball into a net, and the net threw the ball back to us. And this is something like throwing every action of ours against our potential perfection, and the degree in which it is absorbed is the degree in which that action is in line or in harmony with our potential perfection, and the degree in which it comes back to us is the degree in which it is not in harmony with that potential perfection. But I think the analogy of the river gives us a new idea of this law of cause and effect. We can visualize all our actions being tossed into the currents of that river and its whirlpools and thoroughly mixed in the great matrix of interconnectedness. That action is then returned to us, adjusted, not personally, not our personal karma, as it's sometimes called, but according to the needs of our individuality in relation to the needs of the whole of which it is an integral part. And again, from this flow of the mighty river, we can take another idea. It is not easy for us to realize the sense of personal I-ness, which is so dear to us, and even the spiritual individuality, which is a basic theosophical concept you'll hear about in the next lecture, are in the last analysis nothing but self-created obstacles to the flow of life energies. Action on the physical, emotional, or thought level, which has the quality of oneness, loving and compassionate action, is in complete harmony with the flow and creates no obstacles whatsoever. But so much of our action is not in harmony with the flow, and that is how the obstacles of our personality are created. So our self-identity, which is the product of self-consciousness, our awareness of ourselves and what we are, will be buffeted by the life flow until it becomes perfect action and is totally harmonized with the energies of the oneness. And when we achieve this, we become enlightened or self-realized or liberated beings. We become one with the oneness. But this time is ahead for most of us, and our imperfect action and unrealized potential abilities remain as obstacles and are carried over from life to life as the moral kernel, which the Buddhists say is the only self we have. You come to think of it, it's the imperfections and the obstacles that are ourselves. That which is in tune with life is not us, because it's life and is not an obstacle. If we really look at ourselves from this point of view, we find that what we are as individuals, in fact our own concepts of ourselves and the concepts of others, which others have of us, are in reality nothing more than the sum of the obstacles we have created against the life flow. And these elements in our nature, which are not obstacles to the flow, I'm sorry, it's those elements in our nature which are not obstacles to the flow, are one with it and cannot be identified as the individual separate self. Now, Madame Blavatsky was aware of this when she described the nature of the one reality as without attributes. And Ken Wilber, the same author, in his book, The Spectrum of Consciousness, calls this the seamless coat of reality. Now, I had at one stage this ball to illustrate this. But if you can imagine a large ball with an absolutely even coat and all one color, then if you put an ant on that ball, it could go round and round and round and round and would never know where it was going or where it was getting to. Are you with me? Because that's oneness, or the nearest we can get to an understanding of oneness. If the consciousness of the ant would be limited to the surface of the ball, and it would be confused, because it must have a mark or a imperfection on the surface of that ball to give it a point from which to navigate. Are you with me? Now, as soon as you put that mark or point on the surface of the ball, you've got duality. You've got that mark and a surface which does not have the mark. And as soon as you have duality, then the mind has got something to play with. And this featureless or seamless coat of reality can be looked upon as the one consciousness, which H.P. Blavatsky told us was shared by all. There is really only one consciousness, that divine energy field. And our consciousness, we make use of part of that divine energy field as our consciousness. You can call it pure consciousness. You can call it mind or divine mind. It doesn't matter what words you use. But because we are self-conscious individual units of life, each of us has built up features on that seamless coat of reality. Our memories, opinions, and habitual ways of acting and reacting in thought, feeling, become for each of us the personalities or masks. Now, the meaning of the word personality is mask, the mask that the Greek players used to use, behind which the face is hidden, and the mask has its expression, which is untrue, illusory. So we are hidden behind these masks with an illusory world of the personality based on subject-object relationships. We here and that out there. And we forget the seamless coat of reality which is behind all existence. And by building up this self-created world of consciousness, we become aware of ourselves as separate from the things outside ourselves, and in so doing build up obstacles to our understanding of oneness and dull the sense of wonder we should feel towards all nature. Now this is a little difficult. This is subject and object relationship. I'm now going to go into a little more difficult world and tie this up with the way in which the transpersonal psychologists and the physicists are today looking at this subject. Because at the same time, in this process, there is something we cannot see, and that is our own true nature. Some scientists, especially physicists who have worked in the field of subatomic particles, have found that there is an interrelatedness between the observer and that which is being observed. As a result, they have given us helpful insights into the oneness which is the reality behind human consciousness. I'm quoting from G. Spencer Brown, a physicist. And it isn't in vague scientific language, it's straightforward. The world we know is constructed in order to see itself. But in order to do so, it must cut itself into at least one state which sees and another state which is seen. In this severed state, what it sees is only partially itself. In any attempt to see an object, it must act to make itself distinct from that object and therefore false to itself. Heisenberg, another scientist who was the one who created the uncertainty principle, Schrödinger, and even Einstein himself all say that the texture of reality is one in which the observer and the event, the subject and the object, the knower and the known are not separate, and are not separable. They are one. This type of knowing is non-dual, intimate and direct, and it does not submit to codification or analysis. Schrödinger says, all consciousness is one. The one reality can be approached subjectively by your inside consciousness or objectively by understanding that which is outside you. The external world and consciousness are one and the same. And to sum up this concept of oneness, I'll put forward this, what I hope is a summary. This particular quotation is an excellent summary, but I'm going to give you another summary later. The real knower is one with the universal knowledge. I'm sorry. The real knower is one with the universe of knowledge. Everything you observe is none other than you who are observing it. When you go right down to the very basis of your consciousness, you will find the universe, not the false universe of objects out there, but the real universe, which is no longer imagined as split into subject versus an object. At the very bottom of yourself, or you could say at the innermost point of your consciousness, the real you, that point which is the center of your existence. At the very bottom of your consciousness, you fall out of yourself into reality. At the very innermost point of your consciousness, you fall right out of yourself into reality, into oneness. This oneness has been expressed in different ways in different religions, or the experience of oneness has been expressed in different ways in different religions. It is the fullness of the seeming void, a lovely phrase, the fullness of the seeming void to the Zen Buddhist. It's nirvana to the Buddhist. It's samadhi or moksha in Hinduism. And in Christian mysticism, it was called the cloud of unknowing, and there's an anonymous book, that title, very beautiful book. Because the cloud of unknowing is the knowing that is beyond the mind. Or you can call it cosmic consciousness. And there's a book by Dr. Buck that covers a lot of examples of experiences of this. Or you can call it Christ consciousness. You can call it universal consciousness. You can call it the experience of oneness. And we do experience this reality in the pauses between thought, because it's the cessation of thought that allows us to be aware of oneness. For the same reason, we can experience it in the moments of greatest creativity or creative activity, as intuition or as ecstasy. The saints would talk about ecstasy. Today, it's usually talked about as creativity, which composers and artists experience, or as intuition, an understanding of the powers that are beyond the mind, or an experiencing of the powers beyond the mind. During such moments of inspiration, the mind is quiescence. And the emotional nature is dominant. I changed my notes this morning when I reread this, and I said the emotional nature is alert and poised. In fact, the mind should be held poised too. The mind should not be active, but it should be, as it were, focused and poised. And the emotional nature should be allowed full rein, but not in a turbulent state, but in a poised and harmonized state. Mind and heart harmonized. Such an experience of oneness is experienced only when the everyday mind, which is based on duality, is still. It is experienced in the heart and not in the mind, or it is experienced when heart and mind are balanced. All those who have experienced this oneness testify that it's a level of consciousness which is indescribable, a glory of light and bliss and joy. And to experience the reality of oneness, we must live in the present moment. Do you realize that the past is just recalled memory and the future is just memory projected into the future? Both the past and the future exist only in the present, the eternal now. And to be fully aware in the present moment, to act always with choiceless awareness, is the way of life which opens for us the gateway to reality. And how few, how difficult it is to do this. But we can try. We should be intensely interested in everything we're doing at the present moment and put all our heart and mind into it. So let me now try to sum up the thesis of this address in a few brief words. We are in no way separate from the wholeness, which is the energy field of the one life. We are in no way separate from it. But our minds create obstacles to the flow of the one life, and it is these obstacles which become ourselves, our self-identity, our personalities or masks. Loving action, which is free of self-centeredness, self-interest, creates no obstacles, and ultimately when all our action is perfect and harmonized, it will dissolve into the perfection which is oneness, as expressed in The Light of Asia, the very beautiful book by Sir Edwin Arnold. The dewdrop, the individual dewdrop, slips into the shining sea of oneness. And fourthly, because of his fundamental identity with the one life, man is potentially a creator in his own right, and he can add his contribution to the smooth flow of the life energies, or he can create obstacles. The choice is his. He does this as he forgets his self. He adds to the flow, he makes the flow stronger, as he forgets his self-created little personality self in a genuine and real interest in the welfare of all humanity. This is the empathy and compassion which comes when one's life activities spring from love, the all-embracive, all-embracing, non-selective love, which is the very nature of oneness. And when we have this love in our hearts, we can experience the wonder of flowing completely in harmony with the great river of life and sharing its divine energies.